from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Well, the Synod on the Family has now concluded, but there's still plenty to unpack. This week on Register Radio, Jeanette DeMello and Edward Penton discuss takeaways from the Synod on the Family and what lies ahead. Also, do ghosts really exist? Jeanette and Register blogger Thomas McDonald explore what the Church has to say about phantoms. Welcome again to Register Radio, a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm Tom Price, along with Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the Register. Thanks for joining us. Our first guest, Edward Penton, is the Register's Vatican correspondent. He began reporting on the Pope and the Vatican with Vatican Radio before joining the Register team more than 10 years ago. For the last year or so, he has led the Register's coverage on the Bishop's Synod on Marriage and the Family. He's with us again to discuss the conclusion of the Synod on the Family and what lies ahead.
Well, Edward Penton, it's great to have you back on Register Radio. We've been speaking to you a lot in the last 3 or 4 weeks, especially due to the Synod. And now the Synod has concluded a week ago. And my first question really is how are you and what's the atmosphere in Rome right now?
Well, thanks for having me on again, Jeanette. It's pretty good, really. I think people on sort of all sides of the debate are kind of happy with what happened. It was a rather difficult 3 weeks, as we know, and there's lots of debate.
Yes.
But it was generally rather, I think Cardinal Donato put it right, it was convivial. There's lots of conviviality, but it wasn't harmonious. And I think there was disagreements, of course.
Sure.
But in the end, they sort of ironed out, and I think there was a sort of consensus document at the end, which people could vote on. And I think they were generally okay with it. I mean, that's not to say there aren't problems with the final
document. Yes, and we'll get into those. We'll get into those.
Yes.
Yeah, we'll get into all those problems because I think it's important that we talk about the areas that people feel weren't completely harmonious, I guess, with the full majority. But let's talk a little bit about what's next. You know, when this concluded, the final document is a recommendation to the Holy Father, and no one was really sure whether the Holy Father would actually write his own document.
Yes.
We're hearing something different now. What's going on?
Yes. Well, first of all, there wasn't really confirmation that it was going to be a final report published. So that's something that we actually did see the final report. And that was made public. So that was something. And that was what a lot of the Synod Fathers wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of the final report, in the last paragraph, in fact, the last sentence, the Synod Fathers say they would invite the Holy Father to write a document on the family to sort of sum up what happened at the Synod. And we've heard yesterday from Cardinal Parolin, who's the Vatican Secretary of State, that the Pope will be writing a post-synodal apostolic exhortation, which is the document that's traditionally given by the Pope at the end of a synod, basically summing up what's happened and giving his kind of take on it and definitive kind of position on it. So that's quite something that's going to happen, because we understood that the Pope actually didn't really have a lot of time for the post-synodal apostolic exhortations. He prefers to write his own documents rather than sort of
by committee,
go on the sort of direction of others. But anyway, that's something. So that'll be coming out. We don't know exactly when, but the head of the Jesuits, Father Nicholas, said that he expects probably it to come out not less than a year, probably in a few months. Usually it comes out about a year after a synod.
Right.
But I think it's probably going to be sooner than that.
Right. Actually, Father Nicholas, I saw a quote where he was saying any kind of businessman or someone who deals with directing others knows that if you wait more than 8 months, you've lost everyone. So, and you have to start over.
Right.
So that's what he was saying. He thought it'd be less than that. And well, that's quite a development for the Holy Father to write something. Of course, you know, this is the kind of document that was written by Pope John Paul after a synod of the family that he held. It was what yielded Familiaris Consortio, which was quoted in this final document that the Synod Fathers put together. This is Jeanette DeMello on Register Radio, and I'm speaking to our Rome correspondent, Edward Penton, and we're talking about the close of the Synod and the document that was released by the Synod Fathers. Let's talk a little bit, Edward, about the final document. As you said, it doesn't... it doesn't solve every concern, yet it does have a lot of consensus. Let's talk first about the points of consensus. I mean, the paragraphs were voted on, and all of them, except for I believe two, received a very high majority consensus. So let's talk about what got consensus.
Yes, I mean, they all received a two-thirds majority, and so the issues, for example, on better preparation for marriage, the issues of just helping families, focusing on good families and what they can offer to mm-hmm. those other families who are having difficulties. These were the kind of key points that came out of the Synod. And of course, accompanying those who are suffering and wounded, these were very prominent positions which got very unanimous votes. So that was a positive element of this, and there was great kind of unanimity. Well, not mm-hmm. total unanimity, but there's high votes on all of those issues, and also on those which weren't so prominent in the West. Of course, I mean, there's things like families suffering from persecution and how they can be better helped, and those in poverty and so forth. So these were all very positive elements to the Synod, and I think generally there was a great sense of achievement in this Synod. I think they were happy that, you know, these issues were dealt with, and, you know, there was a positive resolution to these things, and they could go back to their diocese with things to take forward and to build on. So that was very positive. But there were difficulties, of course, the main one being on divorce and remarriage.
That's right.
Which I can go into now if you like.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's important to talk about that because, you know, one of the things I was going to mention was the media. There seemed to be almost two synods. You know, there was the synod of the media, what we heard about through the media, and then there was the mm-hmm. real synod where they had the small groups and they talked about all of these things related to family that weren't making it to the media. The things yeah. you said, like the persecuted, how to help families of the persecuted Christians. And those kind of things. So the thing that did make it to the media, obviously, was communion for divorced and remarriage. So how did the fathers deal with that issue in the final document?
Mm. Well, first of all, it's important that although it does sound a very sort of small issue, its implications are enormous if this mm-hmm. is allowed to go through. I mean, the argument is that if divorced and remarried Catholics can receive Holy Communion, then it allows all those in extramarital unions to kind of be validated by the Church. So mm-hmm. it's a very important point, even though a small one. But as you say, that it kind of took prominence over other issues in the Synod, and for good reason, really, because the final document, although it doesn't mention Holy Communion for remarried divorcees, it doesn't sort of rule it out in a very explicit way, as it did in Familiaris Consortio, Pope John Paul II's document in 1981. So there is a problem there for some people that there's an ambiguity, or at least it's, as Cardinal Pell said, it's an insufficient discussion of divorce, of communion for divorce and remarriage. So mm-hmm. so that's a problematic for some people. And, you know, Cardinal Casper, who listeners will know, was pushing the Cardinal Casper proposal for Holy Communion for remarried divorcees. I mean, he saw it as a success and as opening the door to his proposal. So others, of course, didn't. And Cardinal Pell was one of them, who said, you know, communion wasn't mentioned at all in those paragraphs. It won't be taken forward.
Yes, that was a very interesting perspective. I mean, if you look at media reports this week, after this Synod report was released, you see very, very mixed headlines. I mean, you see on one side the Casper camp, if you will, won, and then you see on the other side, sometimes it says, you know, that the conservatives won over the Synod. And it's a very interesting discrepancy. It's a very stark discrepancy that there is something inconclusive about the Synod if it can be interpreted in two ways like that. And so I think what you've said, and quoting Cardinal Pell, is really important. It's insufficient. And I think that's why many people are looking forward to what the Holy Father might say, to see if he provides a more complete answer to that question. I guess that's what's expected, is it not?
That's right. I mean, some people have been saying, following the Cardinal Casper's comments and others, who have been saying, you know, well, it does open the door slightly to communion for divorce and remarriage in the internal forum, i.e. in the mm-hmm. confessional, with a priest guiding them and their conscience. That needs to be kind of nipped in the bud. And some people have been saying, well, we need to get, you know, cardinals to come out and say, this, you know, this excludes Holy Communion. It doesn't say Holy Communion is allowed, doesn't even mention it. So there needs to be kind of an explicit statement from cardinals, from some important cardinals, to say that this isn't the case. But I think others are saying, well, we need to wait for what the Holy Father says, because his report is definitive, and what he says is ultimately what's important. So I think that's probably what's going to hold sway, is there'll just be a wait and see attitude to see what the Holy Father says in his apostolic exhortation, and whether he does give clarity on this issue, because that whole paragraph was really a fruit of compromise, really, with the German bishops who are pushing for communion and those who weren't. But people want to know a bit more clarity, I think, going forward.
This is Jeanette DiMello on Register Radio, and I'm speaking to our Rome correspondent, Edward Penton, and we're talking about the close of the Synod and the document that was released by the Synod Fathers. And we should say that the document hasn't yet been translated officially into English, so it is very difficult for our English audience to get a full picture of what this document is all about. Of course, some of those most controversial paragraphs have been translated, and we've got those on the Register's website, ncregister.com, in Edward Penton's blog. And so, Edward, as you said, we are waiting on the Holy Father to make some clarifying statements, or even some of the cardinals to make some clarifying statements. And we've had Cardinal Pell make some statements where he feels confident that this document says what it intended to say, even though it may be incomplete. Edward, what will people do with this document in the meantime? I mean, how do the Synod Fathers, do they return home and start using this document in any way? What's going to happen in between?
Well, I don't think it really is for the bishops to take home as yet, as it is, to work on. I think it was always going to be, as the Synod of Bishops is meant to be, an advisory body for the Pope to take a decision on what to do going forward. So it's always a consultative sort of body. But at the same time, I think it does give certain direction for bishops on how to deal with issues. And I think they found it very helpful in terms of clarifying for themselves what issues should be take priority and how to deal with them. So I think there will be some of that going for them going back. But I think we still have to wait for the Pope's final decision on this. I think the hope is that it won't be too long coming.
That's right. Well, Edward, we're so grateful for the reporting that you've done. You were producing at least a story daily for those 3 weeks, and that's a tough job. And we appreciate the information you've brought us, and we look forward to what's to come. So thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Jeanette. Thank you.
When we return, what does the Church have to say about ghosts? On this Halloween weekend, we talk phantoms with Register blogger Thomas McDonald. This is Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. More in a moment.
In today's world, we have all kinds of misinformation and even disinformation about Christianity, Catholicism, and religion in general. And we need a source that is going to give us direct quotations and authentic news about what is going on in the church, so we know what the Pope really said and not what the media said he said. We need to know what the Synod is doing, what the encyclicals mean, in order to be able to give the facts of our faith. For that reason, we need the National Catholic Register, which will give us the good news along with the hard news of our world today. And in that way, we can have what we need to go out to our world and give them the good news of Jesus Christ.
For a free 6-issue trial of the National Catholic Register, go to EWTN.com and click on the banner for the Register, or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. Along with Jeanette DeMello, I'm Tom Price. Our next guest, Thomas McDonald, has been a writer and editor for the past 25 years, covering technology, history, archaeology, games, and religion. He writes about archaeology and history for the Register each week. Thomas has a real fascination with the universality of ghost stories. He says they're told in all cultures and are actually quite prominent pretty much everywhere. And there's a very simple reason for that. The ghost story points to the afterlife. We want to know what lies beyond that dark veil that separates the living from the dead.
Tom, it's great to have you on Register Radio. You've been blogging for the Register for the last couple months now on a very regular basis, and it's really great to have you in that capacity. So welcome on board as a Register blogger. And we've got a great topic today. We're talking about ghosts. And of course, at this point in time, it's Halloween, and people's interest in the supernatural just increases probably a hundredfold on a day like today. And why is that? Why is there such a huge draw and interest in ghosts?
Nowadays, I think it's simply that basic, you know, gut visceral reaction to a spooky story that we all want. But the church has a long history of this going back. And in the very early days, and I think we still see some echoes of it now, our skeptical minds have a little more trouble maybe grasping it. But in the very early days of the church, there was no question about the existence of ghosts among the people who were the early Christians. It wasn't, did that ghost exist or didn't it? It was, is it a good ghost or a bad ghost? And the importance to the Christian community about these visions, and they came in two types, either waking or sleeping, what we called oniric visions, was what did they say about life after death, about the progress of the soul from life into beyond. Now, that meshed with very particular pagan views that had to be developed and worked out over about four centuries, culminating in a very rich conversation by St. Augustine.
You know, it's kind of strange to me that that was just the fact. It was just believed. And I think part of that is because today, I mean, we're interested in this supernatural phenomena, but at the same time, there's, whether it might be fear of it or they're just a complete rationalism, no way. There's just nothing after life.
Sure.
And it was more natural for them, obviously. And it was it because they were trying to combat so many different ideas of life after death?
Well, it's interesting. If you see the early rituals of the church, you find it in the Confessions with Augustine and Monica, him imploring her not to go to the gravesite with food for ritual meals. This was part of the common way of ushering the dead through what was believed to be a hostile passageway between life and the afterlife. So Augustine had no patience for this at all. Augustine is very, very modern in his thinking of this. And in the piece I did today, it's called on the Register, Augustine Evodius and the Ghost of the Scribe. It's a dialogue with Bishop Saint Evodius and Saint Augustine in letters in which they talk about a ghostly vision twice, you know, the same ghost seen twice, that Evodius and Augustine don't ever doubt that this vision was real. They're just trying to make sense of it. Augustine rejected wholly that it was a spirit of the dead somehow coming back into our world. He said that's just not possible. And he actually tended to attribute a lot of this to either, and along with some other early church fathers, to either psychological issues, it was a psychological projection, very modern, forward-looking thing there, or, as with Tertullian and others, that it was simply demonic mischief, you know, was the behind some of these apparitions. But what you see is trying to put aside some of this notion that you had to do certain things to get the soul from the dead and into heaven, into the vision of God, you know. There were some, like Cyprian would have said, you close your eyes in this life and open them on the face of God. Tertullian would have said, eh, you just wait around till the second coming. So there are different ideas.
Yeah.
Where's the soul? And this is still relevant to us. We really want to know. So we're kind of fascinated with these stories in the one sense that they're kind of cool and creepy and they kind of are fun to talk about. In the other sense, they're very profound because they touch us right where we live, so to speak, which is, where is our soul? What is the fate of our soul in eternity?
This is Jeanette DeMello on Register Radio. I'm speaking to Thomas McDonald, and we're talking about a couple of posts that he's done on ghosts And what does the Catholic Church say about ghosts? Now, has there been anything conclusive? I mean, we're talking about early church fathers. We're talking about St. Augustine, who we, you know, many, many theologians admire as just such a great. But there's a lot of confusion in those church fathers' contradictions. Has the church come down with anything conclusive?
No. I've done a lot of work on it for like a year and a half or so, and I'm going to be doing more. I have not found a magisterial statement having anything to do with sightings of the afterlife and apparitions. Mm-hmm. However, once we move beyond the early church fathers and we move beyond the patristic era and we move into the Middle Ages, we see an evolution of the idea of ghosts right up until the point where, if you look at the biography of St. Thomas Aquinas by the Vita by St. Bernard Gui, and if you look at the supplement to the Summa that was published after Thomas's death, Thomas flatly says, "It's of course there's ghosts."
Wow.
Yeah, and he has a story of his own that's related in the Vita about his sister's spirit, a vision of his sister's spirit. Remember, some of these were believed to be inner visions, too. We have a lot of, there's a very complex theology we can't even touch on now about, is this an inner vision? Is this a revelation? Is this something we're seeing with our eyes? Is it a matter of vision? This concerns these intellectuals very much. But by the time we get to the Middle Ages and the concept of purgatory was more highly developed, we see early concepts of purgatory, obviously, in Augustine, but by the time we get to the Middle Ages and it becomes more formalized, we tend to lose any doubt at all that people can make themselves known from purgatory, to implore that masses be said for them.
That's right. And, you know, one person who did communicate with he wouldn't call it ghosts, but souls in purgatory, would be Padre Pio. I mean, he had a very big devotion to the souls in purgatory. Are we talking about the same thing when we talk about the souls in purgatory and we talk about the concept of ghosts?
Right. We're into a very complex and subtle issue there, which is the nature of visions, is the nature of what the person who's conveying it is actually seeing. Is it an internal vision? Is it an external vision? Is it a personal revelation? All of these things that the church really hasn't sorted those, and I'd be reluctant to comment on what we're seeing. I believe what Padre Pio and his encounters, those were visions, and their quality, if we were to get into the depth of the complexity of it, like with the Evodius thing I wrote about today, he wondered if, say, there was a sheath of matter, a very fine sheath of matter that made these ghosts visible. You know, and Augustine waved that away. So those are the kind of subtle issues we honestly can't sort. And that's the wonderful thing about the church and about Augustine, too, is that they, if they don't know something, they just say, "I don't know that." And you find that in Augustine. You find that on this issue. He says, "I don't know." So we're willing to kind of say some of these visions, you know. And if you want a good book on visions, a very thin one, A Still Small Voice by Father Benedict Rochelle, the late great Father Benedict, talks about different ways of seeing different kinds of visions and the risks of each of them and how much we can and should pay attention to them.
This is Jeanette DeMello on Register Radio. I'm speaking to Thomas MacDonald, and we're talking about a couple of posts that he's done on ghosts. And what does the Catholic Church say about ghosts? You just brought up something I think is important to talk about. I mean, it is Halloween, and there is an interest not only in the supernatural, but oftentimes in what is demonic and what is truly not something that we should have an idle curiosity over. What would someone like Father Benedict Rochelle or others say in caution about this curiosity towards the spiritual life?
It's natural to be curious about the afterlife. It's even natural, you know, they call it the glamour of evil because it's very attractive and because it hides itself. That's another word for glamour. But the thing you must know, and I say it at the end of all these posts usually, at least in the first round, was never try to contact the dead. It's forbidden, it's dangerous, it's demonic. It will always bring with it terrible, terrible results. If these things were to come naturally as they were in the stories of the saints that we see and that we read, the kind of thing St. Gregory the Great talks about, that's one thing. If we were to go out, and the key text for this is The Witch of Endor and Saul, where she allegedly conjures the spirit, and that every father was unanimous in saying that was demonic, that was a demonic act and a demonic vision that he saw. So it's something to stay way away from. any attempts to do this. But on the other hand, if we read deep into the fathers and deep into our heritage of hagiography, of our saint stories, we find this really rich lore about, it's not just, you know, kind of spiritually affirming that, yes, you know, there is a purgatory. We do have a kind of a chance there to cleanse ourselves on the way to heaven, if you want to say it that way. But that it's fascinating, but also kind of uplifting and reassuring. And that was kind of the point of some of this literature, that some of these saint stories and some of these visions that we saw, was to kind of remind us that there is hope and that there's something, you know, a little extra. And it, you know, honestly, they were very entertaining and they were very useful for catechizing.
Absolutely. I think it is an opportunity to catechize people. As your post from last year, which can be found at the Register, the title is Ghost and the Catholic Church, Pointing to the Permanence of the Soul. And I think that's a very key point, and that's an opportunity for catechesis, is that
sure.
When we talk about ghosts, when we talk about the spiritual life, the spiritual world, we can talk about the permanence of the soul, and that the soul, there is an afterlife. It does go somewhere. And I'm glad you brought that into this conversation and for enlightening us on what some of the fathers speak about. Thanks, Tom, so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Don't forget, you can listen to our show again by going to ncregister.com. Look for the microphone to listen or download the show. Thanks for joining us on Register Radio. For our producer, Elena Rodriguez, Jeanette, and all of us at the Register and here at EWTN, I'm Tom Price. See you next week.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.